It's been a real privilege to be here as part of this meeting, to take part in the celebration of David's 60th birthday. I have not been a student of David's or a postdoc of David's or a collaborator of David's, but like many of the people that have been attending this meeting, I have been a longtime admirer of David's. Not just an admirer of the physics that he's produced, but I've closely watched the style with which he's gone about it. And I think that his energy, his ingenuity, and his drive are something that all of us in the community admire. And I think we feel extremely fortunate that now he's taken on this role as director of the ITP, because those of us who have worked in particle physics have seen what an impact he can have. And now I think all of theoretical physics is gaining from his role here as director. Now, David's interest historically has been in the world of the very small, in quantum field theory and more recently in superstring theory. So it may seem somewhat incongruous that you're hearing a talk today not about the universe in the very small, but the universe in the very large. But in fact, one of the fundamental things we've learned about the universe in the course of David's career is that there's a very close connection between the cosmos and the quantum. And in trying to explore this connection, we've really been led to a revolutionary new theory of the universe. And that's really what I want to talk about today. Now, of course, questions about how the universe began, where it's going, they've been with us for a very long time. I mean, probably since before recorded history. And to some degree, you know, we could criticize and say that the same questions we asked a long time ago are the same questions that we're asking today. Where did it all come from? Where is it all going? But in fact, it's a little bit unfair, because I think one has to appreciate that something dramatic has happened over the course of the last 80 years in our attempt to try to answer these questions. And that is the advent of a whole host of new technologies that have finally made it possible for us to actually study the universe at large distances. So I think it's important to appreciate that although we have speculated about these questions since, as I said, before recorded history, it's only really in the last 80 years that we've had the technology to begin to test our speculations. So that although cosmology is one of the oldest subjects of human inquiry, it is by some measure one of our newest sciences. Only recently have been able to test our ideas. And the moment we've been able to test them, that's changed our view of the universe. So before 1920, say, a state-of-the-art instrument would be something like the instrument that you see here. And although it's very finely made, you really can't peer very far beyond our own solar neighborhood with such an instrument. Then, due to the advent of new technologies, in particular the ability to build large, very precise mirrors, we suddenly developed the ability, at the beginning of the century, to build large optical telescopes. And these large optical telescopes, for the first time, extended our vision beyond our own galaxy. And then we began to see what the universe is like, be able to get hints from it. So as the field essentially began, the cosmology as a science began at this point. Now, this development occurred, as you imagine, rather slowly. When the field first starts off, it begins rather slowly, and these technological developments took a while to progress. So over the next decades, one began to learn how to build yet better telescopes and do a better job, and one also learned how to build new kinds of telescopes. So an important addition to our repertoire of experiment has been the advent of radio telescopes, dating from just after World War II. And this allowed us to extend our vision of the universe in a different way, not in greater distance, but in the sense that we're now viewing part of the electromagnetic spectrum that we weren't able to view before. So we can get other kinds of data from those kinds of instruments. And again, over the course of the 20th century, our progress in technology improved at a regular, steady pace. But something quite remarkable has happened over the last 10 years, and we're in the midst of really what is a technological revolution as well as a revolution in our theory of the universe. And that is, for various historic reasons, a whole host of new technologies have suddenly become available that allow us to view the universe in different ways than we could before, with much greater precision. So a bunch of separate developments. For example, one of the things we've learned to do is how to make a telescope by not using a single mirror, by using a combination of mirrors. And this was the first attempt to do it, but we've now learned how to to improve this that we, for example, now have the giant Keck telescopes, which are about 2.5 times the size, and the mirror size, about 2.5 times the size of the best single mirror telescope we were able to build previously. And we're already talking about a factor of making the next round telescope a factor of 10 times bigger than, say, Mount Palomar. So I think of Mount Palomar as being created around the same time as the Empire State Building. This is talking about building something equivalent to building a building which is 10 times the height of the Empire State Building. So you can imagine what an impact that's going to have on our view of the universe. In radio astronomy, we've learned how to couple, not just have a single telescope, but how to couple whole arrays of radio telescopes, so that we now have a single coherent array of telescopes that acts like a giant telescope which stretches over miles, or in some cases, thousands of miles. We've learned how to put telescopes in space. This is the Hubble Space Telescope being unloaded from the bay of the shuttle. We've learned how to put telescopes in space, and that's an important advantage because for some purposes, the atmosphere really obscures our vision of the distant universe. So being able to put a telescope in space, even if it's not as big as the biggest telescopes we can build on Earth, gives us important advantages. And then we've also learned how to build satellites, which are able to detect radiation in yet other regimes, in the infrared and the microwave. And that's been particularly important for a field of cosmology, because the microwave radiation we receive is from the very distant edges of the observable universe, and comes from a time when the universe was just in its infancy. And it's been a very important tool in our being able to probe the early evolution of the universe. So all these new technologies are coming to bear in cosmology all at the same time. So that suddenly we've gone from a situation where we were data poor. We get one little bit of information one decade and another bit the next decade. We suddenly find ourselves in a position where we're getting whole slews of data all at once. And effectively what's happening is that we're getting our first precise view of the universe out to the very edges of the physically accessible universe, the part from which we can possibly receive light. So think about that for a moment. We've been speculating about the nature of the universe since before recorded history, and now we're going to be the first humans to actually see what it actually looks like. So we're quite privileged in this historical sense. Now, when you suddenly open up new windows on the universe and you see something for the first time, you shouldn't be surprised if you find surprises, if in fact whatever you thought before suddenly has to change. And that's exactly what we're seeing is happening in our view of the universe. So you might divide our views of the universe into various regimes. I might first of all talk about what I'll call the pre-scientific age, the pre-scientific view of the universe, before we really had the instruments to actually test our ideas. And at that time, over the most of this pre-scientific age, the dominant view of the universe was that we live in a static universe, a universe that is the same now as it's always been. So we live at no special time and at no special place in this picture. And this was a view that was shared by Newton through Einstein. And of course, there were other people who had other ideas over time, but that was the dominant scientific view. Then the telescopes turned on. The first thing we discovered is that idea is wrong. That in fact, the universe is expanding and the galaxies are moving away from us and space is stretching according to the laws of general relativity. And so that led to a second view of the universe, which is the hot Big Bang picture, which is held sway from, well, roughly 1920 to 1980. And according to this picture, the universe began as a very dense, tiny region of space filled with elementary particles, the kind of particles that David likes to explore, filled with a uniform soup of these very hot gas, of these elementary particles. And suddenly, for reasons we don't understand, it suddenly began expanding at a fantastic rate. And then over time, it's been expanding and cooling. And the whole history of the universe is simply a progression from a hot universe to a cold universe. And as the universe goes from hot to cold, there's a steady progression in which structure begins to form. First, quarks come together to form protons and neutrons. Then protons and neutrons come together to form the first nuclear elements. Then the first atoms form. Then they form molecules. Then matter begins to cluster in large groups to form structure on various scales. And finally, we get stars and galaxies and clusters of galaxies and the like. So in this picture, the universe is undergoing, if you like, a state of steady evolution from something simple and hot to something more and more complex and cold. And that's kind of an appealing picture in a certain sense. It sort of projects ourselves as being part of a steady evolutionary chain from simple to complex, and we are sort of the current most complex beings around. But it's not clear if this picture is correct, and maybe by the end of the lecture you might have a different point of view. It's not clear it's correct because the hot Big Bang picture, although it has extraordinary successes, also has a number of features of the universe which it doesn't explain. And that's forced us to a reconsideration of what the overall story is like. So it does explain, for example, that the universe is stretching and that the galaxies are moving away from us. It does allow us to explain how it is we have the current abundance of nuclear elements we have in the universe today. Why there is, for example, 75% of the universe is composed of the ordinary matter in the universe is composed of hydrogen and 25% is helium. That owes itself to events that occur in the first few minutes or first few seconds after the Big Bang. And we understand that in fine detail. And we also understand that because the universe was once hot and cooled, that there should be radiation left over from a period when the universe transformed from a hot, opaque thermal plasma into a gas full of neutral atoms and became transparent. We should see radiation from that period. And of course, I'm sure you've all heard of the famous discovery of Penzias and Wilson in the 1960s, that we do see that radiation, that microwave radiation, raining in on us from all directions in the sky. So all this is explained by the hot Big Bang model. So it's a success in this sense. But there are certain things that the Big Bang model does not explain, and that's what's forced us to a reconsideration. So, for example, it doesn't explain why it is the universe is so uniform. When we look at this microwave background radiation, for example, what we see is that around the sky, it's at very nearly the very same temperature, no matter what direction we look. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is if we're looking over, comparing the radiation over here, say, to the radiation over here, we're comparing two regions which, according to this model, have never had a chance to communicate with one another. They were so far apart at the time they emitted their light that light did not have a chance to travel from this region of space to this region of space. You might think, but weren't those regions much closer together in the past? Sure they were, but the universe was much younger, so light had even less time to travel. So if you take account of the fact that the universe has a finite age, and take account of how far apart these two regions were, you discover that at least according to this Big Bang model, those regions never had a chance to communicate. And yet when we measure the temperature of those two different regions, it's the same to within one part in 100,000. Now, I challenge you to try to make a container of soup, which has its, even though it's a closed container, you have total control of it, you know, to make a container of soup, which has the same temperature throughout, within one part and 100,000. That's an extremely difficult thing to do. It seems to require some sort of conspiracy. And yet, the Big Bang model says there was no chance of a conspiracy. There's no chance for communication between these different regions. So the Big Bang model doesn't explain this. It simply takes it as an assumption that somehow the universe began this way. Now, the second problem is explaining why the universe is flat. Why it is, for example, that light travels in straight lines throughout the universe. The problem there is that according to the theory of general relativity, space may be curved or it may be flat. But the probability of its being curved is exponentially greater in the Big Bang picture than if it's being flat. We've gone to measure the curvature of the universe and we find that it's flat. So what explains that? Why does the universe happen to start off in this very unusual state of being Euclidean and flat? Why did the galaxies form? We just talked about the fact that the universe is uniform. When you're viewing the radiation that came from its early stages, the universe is so uniform. So how come when we look nearby, matter occurs in lumps, stars and galaxies and clusters of galaxies? How do we make a universe which, on the one hand, is very uniform in the past and at great distances, and on the other hand, lumpy at short distances? And it's more complicated than that because, in fact, it's lumpy in a very particular way. So we know a lot about the organization of matter in the local universe. So to imagine constructing a situation that you could get this combination of effects, well, that's quite challenging. And then there's some surprises that have occurred even more recently that, again, aren't explained by the Big Bang model. For example, we've recently discovered that the expansion rate of the universe is not slowing down, as everyone expected, but it's, in fact, accelerating. It's, again, another feature that's not explained by the model. So this is an interesting situation that sometimes occurs in theoretical physics, that it's not that the model is wrong. It's not that you can say there's something, the Big Bang model predicts something that's incorrect. But it's a situation where the model is incomplete. There's huge pieces of the story that it just doesn't explain. It doesn't explain these things. It doesn't give a contradictory prediction. But it seems rather peculiar within the context of this model that the universe should have all these features. And so it calls for an enhancement of the theory. And you could think of this enhancement as being a revolution, or you could think of it as a minor or a minor change, depending on how you want to look at it. One of these revolutions that's taken place has been the idea of inflation and the concept of an inflationary universe. So this is an idea that first arose in the 1980s, and it arose in large part because of ideas that were brought over from the quantum field theory that David pursues, being brought over to cosmology. And in particular, a number of us who were trained as particle physicists and who learned from David tried to bring ideas over from quantum field theory to try to understand events that might have occurred in the early universe that might explain some of these puzzles. And this led to the idea of inflation. Now, inflation is, by some measure, a minor change in the history of the universe as viewed from the hot Big Bang picture. It only changes the history of the universe over a period somewhere between 10 to the minus 35th seconds to 10 to the minus 30 seconds. So as viewed in time, in terms of the clock time, it seems like a very minor amendment. And just to emphasize how small these numbers are, I mean, that's 10 to the minus 35th seconds, and that's 10 to the minus 30 seconds. And that's all we're going to change the story. That's as much as we're going to change the story. But what's going to occur during this period is something incredibly dramatic. The universe is going to undergo more expansion during this brief instant of time than it has in this entire 15 billion years since. All the matter and radiation that we see today is going to be generated during this period. And the seeds are going to be laid down, which eventually form the galaxies. So everything that's in the universe that we see today is very much dependent upon the events that occur in this brief period. So it's really, I would say, in my point of view, properly viewed as a radical departure from the Big Bang picture. Now here's the elements of the inflationary theory. It involves essentially three essential ideas. First of all, the idea of vacuum energy. Secondly, the idea of hyperexpansion. And thirdly, the idea of vacuum decay. So let me walk through each of those components and talk about how they play a role in the theory. So let's first of all talk about vacuum energy. So the idea of vacuum energy certainly sounds like an oxymoron. I mean, a vacuum contains nothing, and yet we're talking about energy of the vacuum. What's going on here? Well, it's somewhat a matter of language. Empty space can have energy. Where by empty space, what I mean is something that's emptied from all the particles and radiation that we normally think of when we think of there being something in space. When we think of there being something in this room, say, for example, we think of the particles that compose the gas in this room. Even though you may take a box, say, and evacuate it from all the matter that's in it, it's still possible that it can contain energy. For example, you can take two opposite sides of that box, attach two metal plates and attach that to a battery. And now, inside the box, there's still nothing in the sense of there being no particles, but there is something in the sense of there being energy. There's an electric field, and the electric field carries energy. You can't see it, but it's there. You want to be sure that it's there? Well, drop an electron into the box, and you discover that instead of the electron moving as it would if the box were truly had no energy, that is to say, instead of moving in a straight line, you'll see that electron travel on a curved path and approach one of the plates. And that's because it's absorbing some of that vacuum energy, or converting some of that vacuum energy into kinetic energy. Okay, so there really is energy inside that box. Well, in the same way, one of the things that we've learned about the early universe from quantum field theory is that there are a number of other fields, not electric fields so much, but other fields that would be around in the early universe that would contain energy and which could be the dominant form of energy in the universe. And so exactly what happened before this period is up for debate, but at some point, according to the inflationary theory, one or more of these fields came to take over the energy of the universe, and the universe became empty of all matter and radiation, any of the matter and radiation as we know it, and the only form of energy that the universe contained, essentially, was this kind of field energy or vacuum energy. Well, this is an idea, this idea of the vacuum energy comes from particle physics. We now unite this with general relativity to ask, what would be the effect of vacuum energy on the expansion of the universe? How would that make things different than, say, a universe which contains matter and radiation? Well, in general relativity, a key principle that in terms of the expansion of the universe is that energy is what drives the expansion of the universe. If you want to know how fast the universe is expanding, the fundamental equation says that it depends upon how much energy there is in the universe at that time. And in particular, if you ask how much time it's going to take before the universe stretches and doubles in size, so space is stretching, but we can ask how long it will take for the universe to double in size. Let me call it the doubling time. That depends upon the energy density, how much energy there is in a cubic meter of space. So now let's first of all consider a universe which contains particles or matter in it. I calculate at any given time how much matter there is in it, and I calculate the amount of energy, how much mc squared equals mc squared there is inside that box due to those particles. From that I can compute roughly how much time it's going to take for the universe to stretch and double in volume. By the time it doubles in volume, though, that matter, those particles have spread out, and the density, the number of particles and the amount of energy in a cubic meter, has decreased by a significant factor. So the next time, it's going to take a longer time for it to double, and yet longer the next time, and yet longer the next time. So in a universe that contains particles and radiation, the doubling time is always growing, or it's taking longer and longer to double, or the expansion rate is slowing down. So a universe that contains matter and radiation has the property that the universe, the expansion of the universe, decelerates with time. But now let's suppose the universe has vacuum energy. Suppose that's the dominant form of energy in the universe. Now what happens is the universe stretches by a factor of 2, and stretching means you're making more space. Space has vacuum, but the vacuum has energy, so you've made more energy. And the energy per unit per cubic meter, that hasn't changed. You've made more cubic meters, but the number, amount of energy per cubic meter has not changed. And so the doubling time doesn't change this time. It doesn't slow down. Now, you probably have this evil thought in the back of your mind that he's done something violent to the laws of physics. He's violated the conservation of energy, hasn't he? Because he's saying you're making more space, space has more energy, I'm keeping the energy density fixed, haven't I made more energy by this technique? Well, by all means. But it's not as mysterious as it sounds. It's no more mysterious than what happens when I take this eraser and I drop it. Okay, so if I only thought about the kinetic energy of this eraser, the energy of motion, I would say initially it has zero kinetic energy. Okay, then I release it, and suddenly it takes off. Is that mysterious? Of course not. You know there's another form of energy that we have to consider, which is gravitational energy. There's also a potential energy. And what's happening when I drop this eraser is that I'm transforming potential energy, gravitational potential energy, into kinetic energy. In the same way, the laws of general relativity say that if I have vacuum energy, what gravity does in response to that is it transforms gravitational potential energy into space and vacuum energy. And that just occurs automatically according to those equations. And furthermore, it occurs in a dramatic way. It occurs in such a way as to keep the doubling time fixed. Because the energy unit volume is fixed, the doubling time is fixed. So consider what the effect of this is on the expansion of the universe. According to the kinds of unified theories of the strong and electroweak interactions that David has helped pursue, we believe that the time when the universe would begin to be dominated by this vacuum energy would be a period of around 10 to the minus 35th seconds. There's some flexibility in that number, but that's sort of the typical number that is used in the theory. The theory isn't very sensitive to the particular value. But let's use that as our working value. That's when the doubling begins to start. So after 10 to the minus 35th seconds, the universe doubles in size. But because the doubling time, the universe contains vacuum energy and the doubling time is fixed, now after 2 times 10 to the minus 35th seconds, the universe has increased by a factor of 4. By 3 times 10 to the minus 35th seconds, it's increased by a factor of 8. And you can see how it's going to go. And suppose you only sustain this for a period of 10 to the minus 30 seconds. So we began at 10 to the minus 35th seconds. 10 to the minus 30 seconds is 100,000 times bigger. So that means we've doubled the universe in size 100,000 times. Well, if you've ever played games with factors of 2, you know that 2 to the 100,000 is a rather big number, okay? So, I mean, let's say 2 to the 200 is many more than there are atoms in the invisible universe. And here we're talking about doubling the universe in size by a factor of 2 to the 100,000 power, which is something like 10 to the 30,000 power, so one with 30,000 zeros. So this is an extraordinary expansion that's taken place, much greater than has happened in the universe since that time. Over the next 15 billion years, the universe doubles in size about another 100 times. Okay? But during this brief period of time, it doubles, well, 100,000 times. Actually, I'm being somewhat conservative. Most of the models would predict millions, billions, or trillions of doublings. I chose one of the more conservative cases. So an incredible amount. So a region that would be the size of a nucleus would expand in that brief instant to a size bigger than what we can see yet today. Since the end of this period of inflation, there's simply not been time for us to see to the region of that size. We only see a tiny little corner of a region which underwent this fantastic expansion. Now, what does this fantastic expansion do? Well, imagine taking a rubber sheet which is curved and wrinkled and then suddenly stretching it by a huge amount. It's going to become extremely flat and the wrinkles are going to smooth out. So by this means, you can take a universe which is curved or wrinkly and you'll smooth it out or flatten it out to an incredible degree. Well, that would be that accomplishes one of our goals, except it doesn't take us to a universe in which we live, because if all we have is vacuum energy and hyperexpansion, we end up with a universe which is inflating or expanding at an extraordinary rate, but contains nothing of the sort of stuff we see around us. We have to make sure that we end up with a universe which contains the sort of matter and radiation and structure that we see in the universe today. So we need to get a third idea to complete the story. And once again, we return to quantum physics to introduce a third idea, which is the idea of vacuum decay. So one of the things we learned from quantum mechanics and at the beginning of the 20th century that we observed is the fact that you can have a situation, say, where you have a uranium nucleus, which could be around for 4 billion years, so it looks like it's going to be around forever, but then suddenly it decays, it fissions into lighter products, and energy is released. So it's possible to have the idea that through quantum physics, particles can decay, and that same idea carries over from quantum field theory to the idea that vacuum energy, energy-containing field, can also decay. And so what had to be the third development in the theory of inflation was the idea that one could arrange a situation where one could sustain the vacuum energy would be around for a considerable period sufficient to produce the hyperexpansion that's desired, but then one could have a situation where, say, after 100,000 doublings or a million doublings or a trillion doublings, this vacuum would be unstable and would eventually decay. And when it would decay, what would happen? It would decay into particles and radiation, quarks, electrons, gluons, leptons, the stuff that we see in the universe today. And the universe would suddenly heat up from a vacuum to a hot universe, up to some large, very large, finite temperature. Now, once this happened, of course, that changes the expansion history of the universe, because now when the universe doubles in size, that density decreases. Therefore, the doubling time increases, and the universe is now goes, instead of having the doubling time be fixed, it's now beginning to slow down at a regular pace. So we return to a universe that looks like the hot Big Bang, but its prehistory is entirely different. Now, there's an important result from this idea of vacuum decay that emerges, which is if you think about the case of the uranium nucleus and this kind of decay process, it doesn't occur in a perfectly uniform way. For example, if I've had in this room a bunch of uranium nuclei, uranium-238 nuclei, and I were studying them, I know that I look up in the tables, it says that uranium nucleus has a lifetime of 4.5 billion years. But it's not the case that if I waited 4.5 billion years, all those uranium nuclei would decay. The laws of quantum physics say that, in fact, there's some uncertainty as to exactly when they'll decay, and 4.5 billion years is some average value. In a similar way, when the universe is undergoing this vacuum decay, when this energy that was dominating the universe and causing the hyperexpansion begins to decay, it doesn't decay in a perfectly uniform fashion. Different regions will undergo this decay and heat up at different times. And when they heat up, that means they'll begin to cool in those regions. And because they started off, they decay at slightly different times, the temperature of the universe is not perfectly uniform. I just argued that the stretching makes the universe very uniform, but this decay process sort of undoes that to a tiny degree and makes the universe slightly modeled in terms of the distribution of matter and energy in the universe. So you would have some regions which are slightly hotter than average and denser than average, and some regions which are colder than average, but in a way that we can predict in rather precise detail. Okay, so a very particular pattern of modeling, if you like, in the story. Now, the very exciting developments that have occurred in the experimental side in the last decade has been that we've now been able to develop the instrumentation required to test this theory of inflation by looking for the modeled appearance of energy in the universe in its infancy, by essentially probing through microwave radiation this period when the universe was just being transformed from an opaque thermal plasma into a transparent medium. We receive from that period light, radiation which today is in the microwave regime, receive from that region light from which we can measure the temperature of the universe in different directions in the sky. And we can essentially use this experiment to take a thermometer around the space around us and ask what the temperature of the universe is in different directions in the sky, and see how well it conforms to the kind of modeled appearance that inflation predicts that you should see as being a remnant from the quantum decay, from the vacuum of the vacuum at the end of inflation. So this has been one of the great adventures and enterprises in cosmology and in science over the last decade, and we're just in the midst of these kinds of experiments. This instrument I've shown up here was the first instrument to observe any kind of mild appearance at all in the microwave background. And in fact, the picture that I showed you was not a picture of what inflation predicts, it was rather actually the picture that was obtained from that instrument of what that model appearance looks like. So this is essentially a picture of what the universe looked like in its infancy, when it was a few hundred thousand years old, and this radiation was finally decoupled from the hot thermal plasma which dominated the universe. What happened at that time is that the universe had cooled enough that the first atoms began to form in the universe. And the universe changed from an ionized plasma to a neutral gas of atoms. At the same time, the radiation decoupled from that matter. That is to say, it ceased to interact strongly with that matter and just began streaming in from the universe. You're not going to be able to refine that. You're not going to be able to, that's as good as you're going to get. Because in fact, the picture is fuzzy. The picture of the universe we obtained from COBE is a fuzzy picture. It's a rather low resolution instrument, first of all. And secondly, there isn't any detailed structure to be seen on this scale. You're seeing the picture of the universe in its infancy, you can think of sort of compare it to a picture of yourself 8 hours after conception. So 8 hours after conception, probably that picture wouldn't have been a very impressive picture. But you know that if you actually had detailed information from that picture, you would learn a lot. You could have predicted a lot about yourself in advance, a lot of details about what would happen between then and now. And the same way, by studying this picture in detail and getting finer, higher resolution pictures of this sort, we can learn an awful lot about the nature of the universe. We can test ideas like inflation. So what do we do in the test? Well, formally what we do is we can, for example, take a map like this and compare, say, how different the temperature is in two regions of the sky which were separated by a certain angle. And then we want to get some sort of statistical average over this quantity. So what we want to do is compare two regions of the sky that, say, are separated by 10 degrees. And then take other pairs of points which are separated by 10 degrees. And say on average, how much do I expect the temperature to differ if I take two points which are 10 degrees apart in the sky? Then I'll repeat that again for 20 degrees, 30 degrees, 1 degree, etc. And it's in this way I'm going to get a certain amount of statistical information from this model map, which turns out to be a very powerful fingerprint. It tells us a lot of detail about the origin and evolution of the universe. For example, in the inflationary theory, this is the prediction for what you would find. So in black over here is given the technical jargon of what we're measuring, but in red is given what we're really measuring, okay, which is the temperature difference in two regions in the sky as we change the angle across the sky. So we begin over here on the left-hand side of the diagram, we're saying, what's the temperature difference when I compare two regions which are 90 degrees apart in the sky? And as I move from left to right, I'm comparing regions which are 10, 1, 0.1 degrees across in the sky. In a theory like inflation, or competing theories that are around at the same time, will all make different predictions as to how that temperature will vary with angle. So this is, for example, the inflationary prediction using the best information we have about the fundamental parameters of astrophysics. Now this is the curve, the fingerprint curve, that everyone's out to measure. They're out to take their maps and see how well they can measure this curve. This is the current state of the affairs in 2001. These black points over here are the results of that COBE experiment that I showed you the picture of, the map of. And you can see it actually had poor angular resolution. It only measures the universe out to sort of 90 to 10 degrees. However, that still contains valuable information. It indeed seems to show some sort of plateau over here. And it sees some modeling. But you don't see all the fine detail that you saw on the right of the figure. For that, there's a whole host of new experiments, some of them mounted or led by people here in Santa Barbara, to try to measure, with a finer angular resolution what that map looks like. And we've seen over, especially over the last 3 or 4 years, all these experiments, other than COBE, over the last 3 years, we've begun to see a picture emerge of what's happening as we study this fingerprint plot of the universe. And if you superimpose on that the prediction of inflation, well, this is what Joe was referring to when he said that so far the predictions seem to be very well, doing very well. If we compare the competing models that people had in mind up to this point, they also had rather precise predictions, but they look quite different from this. The curve would have quite different shapes, different bumps, different wiggles, et cetera. It looked quite different. And so this is, so far, extraordinarily good news for the inflationary story. Now, it's not the end. I mean, people are not satisfied with, for example, these very large error bars here and uncertainty over here. So there's already underway a whole host of new experiments to try to improve on the situation. And one of them, in fact, is a satellite experiment that will go up in June called MAP, the Microwave Anisotropy Probe. And it will go out several million miles from Earth, and it will make a series of measurements at much higher resolution than COBE did. And when that information comes back, it will extend, for example, with the range over which we've been able to measure the microwave background, this fingerprint, and it also will reduce the errors to a size which will be roughly the thickness of the curve. Okay, so if you go back a second, you can see what the error bars over here now, but next time when we come back with MAP, you'll see that the error bars over this range will be roughly the thickness of the curve. So then we will really be able to have a really fine test of these ideas. And we'll see, we'll have to see what emerges from that, whether or not inflation still survives the test. Looking at the microwave background isn't the only probe we have to study the inflationary theory, because there's another important implication of that little modeling that you saw in that map. Those little ripples in the energy, in the distribution of energy in the universe. And that is what happens to that rippling if you follow the story forward in time. So suppose we take a little piece of the universe over here, a little chunk of the universe in its early history, in which matter and radiation are distributed nearly uniformly, but not quite. There's those tiny little ripples in the distribution of energy due to the quantum decay of the vacuum predicted by inflation. And let's follow the story forward for a moment, evolve the story forward for a moment to see what happens over the next 15 billion years as you follow the story forward. So here we see this region. Here we see what happens for the first few million years. We can see what happened was a region that was initially very uniform in its distribution of energy with just a little bit of modeling has already begun to break up into fine globules of structure. What's happening is that gravity is drawing in matter and energy towards regions with higher than average density. So those regions become ever denser and have even stronger gravitational forces to draw matter even more rapidly into them. Now at this point, the structure is only there on small scales. But if we follow the story forward in time, we see now structure on yet larger scales forms as these little globules of matter come together to form yet larger structure. The structures we're talking about here are on the scales of huge clusters of galaxies. We see all this interesting action and motion around us, extraordinary detail. We now have the numerical capability of tracing the story forward in time, and we see this fantastic numerical detail. And we can compare this picture with what we actually see in the universe. And this, too, provides important constraints on our understanding of the universe. And thus far, this picture, too, seems to comport marvelously well with what we actually see. Well, this is an example. Well, this is an example so far. This is an example so far of an idea which was originally led by theorists, really came out of theory as an attempt to solve problems of the hot Big Bang model. So to some degree, at least some theorists anticipated the events that we've seen, the need that the universe had to have undergo this period of early acceleration. But we've discovered something else, a surprise during this same period in just the last few years, something we didn't expect, that wasn't predicted. And this again comes because of the development of a new technology. In this case, this new technology is the ability to observe supernova at great distances. So this is a galaxy, here's a supernova going off, and what happens when the supernova is going off is a star, a giant star, is exploding. And so at first it becomes very bright, and then it becomes rather dim. So that's what this curve over here on the right represents. It brightens, and then it dims. Now there's a certain subclass of supernova which go off because what's happening is that they have around them some companion star, and they're accreting matter from that companion star. And at a certain point, when enough matter is accreted, they go off. Critical mass is reached and they go off. So roughly speaking, type 1a supernova go off under common conditions. And so the amount of light they give off is more or less the same from type 1a supernova to type 1a supernova. And if the amount of light they give off is the same, then roughly speaking, we know we can use them as measuring ways of measuring distance in the universe. So for example, if I were to give you a bunch of bulbs which are all labeled 60 watts, and I put them at various distances, you could tell what their distance is from you by comparing how much light you're receiving from them from the wattage that they're supposed to be giving off. I can just use the inverse square law that you all learned in school to determine, compare the brightness at which they appear to be at compared to the amount of light they're giving off to find their distance. So if type 1a supernova are standard candles in this sense, or standard objects of known luminosity in this sense, we can judge their distance from us. Now the story is a little bit more complicated than that. I won't go into the details. They're not exactly standard candles. One has to study them in different colors to really make them standard. But roughly speaking, they can be used as objects of known luminosity to judge distance of the universe. And now we can use them in the same way that Hubble used Cepheid variable stars in the 1920s. What Hubble did is he took stars, in this case Cepheid variable stars, stars which pulsate at a rate which depends upon how bright they are. He used that to judge their brightness or distance. And then he measured the color of the light from them to measure their redshift or blue shift. That's to say, if one looked at atomic spectral lines, how red or blue shifted the spectral lines were compared to laboratory measurements. He used that to measure the velocity from us. And so then he obtained a graph which compared the velocity of objects moving away from us compared to the distance. And what he showed is as you go further out in space, the velocity is increasing with distance. And from that he concluded that the universe is expanding. That's just what you find in an expanding universe, that whichever way you go, things will move away from you at a rate, or recede away from you at a rate which is proportional to the distance. That's what he found. And essentially we're doing the same thing with supernova, but with the one advantage of supernova being that they're much brighter, so you can see them much greater distances. So, excuse the complicated nature of this plot, I just want to describe in words what we're doing over here. We're measuring the magnitude or brightness of these objects compared to the redshift or the velocity away from us. And we're doing it both for nearby supernova, that's what these represent over here, but we're also doing it for distant ones. So for the nearby ones, we're essentially repeating Hubble's experiment, but just with supernova, and we again confirm that the velocity increases with distance, and so that means that the universe is expanding. It just gives us finer grain results of that, a finer result of that measurement. But then the interesting thing is to do measurements out here, because these objects are so far away that we're not really measuring the expansion rate now. We're measuring the expansion rate back when the universe was younger, about a third of its age. And so then we can ask the question, was the universe expanding faster then than now, or slower than now? Now everyone's expectation was that the answer, well, almost everyone's expectation was that the answer was that we're going to be slower. Because we know that matter and radiation resist the expansion of the universe. That should be slowing through its self-gravity, and that should be causing the expansion of the universe to slow down. But in fact, what we see is acceleration. So what does that mean? What's causing the acceleration? Well, we're not really sure. But what it seems to mean, what it must mean, is that most of the energy of the universe is not consisting of matter and radiation, but consisting of energy of some other form. Energy which has the property that, in fact, it gravitationally self-repels and causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate and decelerate. We actually have already seen an example of that when we discussed inflation. Vacuum energy has that property. If you have a field, like the sort that I described before, when I discussed inflation, that is coming to dominate the universe, it can cause the expansion of the universe to accelerate, the doubling time to become constant. So, in fact, one possibility is the vacuum energy consists of something inert that's been the same over time and has no dynamics to it and is unchanging. And we call such energy a cosmological constant, an idea first introduced by Einstein back in 1917. But another possibility, one which is in some ways more appealing from the point of view of fundamental physics, is to imagine it's something more like a field, like what we had in inflation, and something which in fact wouldn't be perfectly uniform, but it would vary over time and have a sort of more modeled appearance, but that would permeate space everywhere and would dominate the universe, causing this expansion that we're seeing. We don't exactly what this quintessence, this energy would consist of, is uncertain. We just give it the generic name quintessence, a term that goes back to actually medieval science, when people were speculating about what causes the motion of stars and planets. They introduced the idea of a fifth element or quintessence that would cause that motion. That term has come back into vogue again now to refer to this energy which is currently dominating the universe and causing this expansion. But its exact source is not known at all, and that is something that will certainly have to emerge from fundamental physics. So let me close with just sort of giving you an overall impression now of what happens if you try to put together the two stories I've told you about inflation and quintessence and the current expansion. So we began with a picture, of a static universe. We then moved to the Big Bang picture, which has sort of dominated the scene for a good period of time. And according to the Big Bang picture, the universe began as a hot universe. It began as a universe that was filled with matter and radiation as we know it. And then the history of the universe was quite simple. It expanded and cooled and grew more complex with time. It was slowing down all the way because the matter and radiation was resisting the expansion, so it's been cooling and slowing down. And its future history was unknown in the Big Bang model. It could be, in principle, that it's decelerating enough that eventually it will stop expanding and recollapse to a big crunch. Or it could be that it's decelerating, but not enough that it'll expand to a big crunch. It'll just continue to slow down forever. So when most of us are brought up in school, we were taught that the big debate was between these two possibilities. Is it decelerating and recollapsing, or is it decelerating forever? But in fact, we now have a rather new view that's emerging in the 21st century, one that is really rather strange. We're not sure if the universe began hot. We're not exactly sure how it began. I think Professor Hawking might talk about his own ideas about how the universe began, but we can no longer tell any longer because of this period of inflation. It kind of blocks our ability to probe what happened prior to inflation. So it's much more speculative as to what happened prior to inflation. But one thing we know that seems to be the case is that at some point the universe became essentially vacuous and frozen, zero temperature, and only contained this vacuum energy. Then it underwent this period of fantastic accelerated expansion. The vacuum decayed and the universe reheated. At that point, it began to expand and cool at the slower rate that we associate with the Big Bang model. But that has only been a temporary phenomenon. That's only lasted for 15 billion years. And now, for reasons that we're just beginning to learn, it seems that the universe is beginning to accelerate once more. So the universe that we think of, a universe composed of ordinary matter, protons, neutrons, stars, galaxies, and the like, which we thought of in the old Big Bang picture as being the result of a steady evolution, okay, now seems to be a brief interlude between two periods of accelerated expansion, two periods of vacuum domination. A rather strange picture, a rather unsettling picture. Okay, it makes you a little uncomfortable. It sort of reduces your feeling of significance in the universe when you hear such a picture. Maybe you have a little sympathy for what people felt like in 1543 when Copernicus published his manuscript on the revolution of heavenly bodies, and he proposed that the Earth is not the center of the universe, that in fact the Earth revolves around the Sun. People were uncomfortable with that then too. But we learned something very valuable from that experience, that becoming to grips with the universe as it is, can be extraordinarily important and instructive to us. Because from Copernicus came a whole slew of ideas over the next 150 years. The development of new mathematics, the development of new physical laws of motion, and Newton's theory of gravity. Well, in my view, this is a revolution of Copernican significance in terms of our view of the universe. It is disturbing, but it also demands explanation. And that explanation is going to have to come from fusing together ideas from fundamental physics, the kind of physics that David has been exploring, what we're actually observing in the universe. And so the only way that progress is going to be made in this field is by seeing a very close interaction between the field of cosmology, the field of astrophysics, the field of fundamental physics, and actually, although I haven't emphasized it, there are ideas in here that are also related to condensed matter physics as well. So, well, this connects us to the ITP, because we're better to pursue this kind of situation where you need to bring together people from different communities, different communities of physics. And indeed, it's not a coincidence, in my view, that this new revolutionary picture of the universe has developed over the last 20 years, which is roughly the same period of the existence of the ITP. One can actually point to various seminal workshops that occurred here in which people were brought together at different periods in the, from different communities at different periods, and which made seminal developments in the story that I just told you. For example, in 1984, shortly after Stephen and myself and Alan Guth and Jim Bardeen and Mike Turner and Alex Starobinsky developed the idea that you could perform fluctuations in the distribution of energy in the universe that could seed galaxy formation. That was in 1982. Shortly after that, there was a workshop here, I think it was 1984, which brought together astrophysicists with particle cosmologists to see what would the implications be for structure in the universe. What would the implications be for the microwave background? And a lot of what I showed you was outcome of that important workshop. And more recently, in 1994, I participated in another workshop where already one could see emerging, even before the supernova experiments, evidence that the universe had to be accelerating. So again, that was another very influential workshop. And we're now talking about having another workshop, I guess another year or so from now, which will push things further. So this is an extraordinarily exciting period for this field, where our view is changing quite radically, and which we have wonderful new puzzles that are a challenge, well, not just to particle physics, not just to cosmologists, but also to fundamental physics, to help us explain what's going on. And I can't think of a better birthday present for David than to present him with new challenging puzzles to solve. Okay, he solved a number of them, but I mean, he has some new puzzles to solve, and I expect this to be an extraordinary period for science, for the ITP, and I'm looking forward to see what happens. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for a really beautiful talk. By the way, in my introduction, I called Paul an expert. I should have made it clear that he is, of course, one of the discoverers of the inflationary cosmology. He's one of the people who figured out what was happening when the universe was 10 to the minus 30 seconds old and apparently got it right. Now, we're running late because of the rain, but I think we do have time for some questions from the general audience. David has said he wants to go first.
I just wanted more of a comment than a reaction. You compare the change in view, acceleration, structure, acceleration, to Copernican evolution. Of course, Copernicus taught us we weren't in any special place in the universe. Things like everywhere else. And this revolution seems to say that might be true as far as space goes, but we're at a very special time. Have a infinitesimally small portion of the life.
Excuse me, David. Can the people in back hear David's question? The acoustics is rather bad in back. I'm going to.
That's a good idea.
Face the back way.
That's a better idea.
So I was just asking Paul about the fact that the difference between the revolution he was describing, the emerging view, and the Copernican revolution was that Copernicus taught us that we were at no special place in the universe. We weren't at the center of the universe, and we've learned more and more that we could be anywhere. But obviously, if this view is correct, we couldn't be at any time. This is a very special and unusual time in the history of the universe, the only time in which structure could occur before and after periods of rapid inflation, which is a bit strange,
yes,
since we are very uncomfortable with assuming that we're at a particular space or time or anything particular. And some of us are a bit disturbed about why we happen to be just at this very special time where quintessence or vacuum energy or whatever it is just balanced with matter and energy and all the rest. There are anthropic explanations of this, which I detest, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering your point of view.
Okay. Let me give this to you so it doesn't interfere with this microphone. Yeah, that is really one of the great mysteries. I mean, this picture says that we are at the end, if you like, of the evolutionary chain of formation of complexity in the universe of ordinary matter. The last structures to form, the biggest structures to form in the universe have already occurred. Structure formation has ended, and the universe is beginning this period of accelerated expansion. So indeed, it totally changes our view of ourselves in the universe by putting us at some sort of special time. I am a very strong opponent of the anthropic kind of solution to these problems, because I just find that totally intellectually unsatisfying. I like sharp, it's a good mystery, and I think a good mystery deserves a good solution. For example, just to give you a concept, one of the ideas that I've been pursuing is that, in fact, the accelerated expansion is linked to the fairly recent transformation of the universe from radiation-dominated to matter-dominated. That's to say, in the early history of the universe, most of the energy consisted of radiation and the kinetic energy of fast-moving particles. And during that period, structure couldn't form in the universe. The universe was expanding too rapidly. But then the universe cooled enough that most of the energy of the universe consisted of the matter contained within it. And then and only then did the structure begin to form. But that same transformation in the history of the universe, the change in the expansion of the universe, can, under some circumstances, trigger some forms of energy to change their behavior. So that instead of behaving like, let's say, radiation, they suddenly begin to behave like a vacuum energy. I'm interested in pursuing ideas like that, where there would be some dynamical relation. In a picture like that, it wouldn't be a coincidence that we happen to be around at the same time that the universe is accelerating. It would be linked in the sense that to make us, we have to have structure in the universe. That requires this transfer from radiation to matter domination. And also to have the quintessence begin to act like a cosmological constant, it too would require that same transfer. So that's an example of an idea which I think is more, I find much more appealing. But it's a wonderful challenge to see how we can, different ways we can find more appealing solutions to it, to the problem.
Are there any further questions?
Hungry people.
I think we're going to lunch on the stakeholder.